Hi, and welcome to Axel Bank Reports, History and Today. Conversations with America's top nonfiction authors and why their books matter right now. I'm Evan Axelbank, and today we're going to speak with Michael Holtzman, the author of Spies and Traitors, Kim Philby, James Angleton, and the Friendship and Betrayal That Would Shape MI6, the CIA, and the Cold War. He's written over a dozen books centering on spycraft in both the fiction and nonfiction categories, as well as books on the role of race in American schools. Thanks so much for being here, Mr. Holtzman.
Thank you very much for having me.
Before we start our interview, I want to invite listeners to our Patreon page to ask for your support in keeping the show going. Go to patreon.com/axelbankhistory. We will donate part of your contributions to a charity for children's literacy. You know the moment in many James Bond movies or Austin Powers or even in 24, the TV show, when you realize that the person you've been sympathetic to, who you assumed, who you knew was one of the good guys, was revealed to be a double agent? Kim Philby is the one you might have looked at and said, "How could you?" Jim Angleton is the character who might have said in the show, "How could you have done this to me, to us, or even how could I have been so stupid?" The story is birthed during World War II. What were they doing and who were they serving or supposed to be serving, Mr. Holtzman?
Thank you. As you know, secret intelligence is tasked with attempting to obtain the secrets of enemy nations, and sometimes nations that are not enemies, and preventing them from obtaining the nation's own secrets. The latter part of this effort is called counterintelligence. Kim and Jim is about the lives, times, and relationships of two intelligence officials, Kim Philby, a Brit, and James Angleton, an American, who eventually specialized in counterintelligence. I think it is to the point to say, to quote something that James Angleton said as he was dying, "You know, the CIA got tens of thousands of brave people killed. We played with lives as if we owned them. We gave false hope. I so misjudged what happened. Fundamentally, the founding fathers of U.S. intelligence were liars. The only thing they had in common was the desire for absolute power. I did things that I regret, but I was part of it and loved being in it. Alan Dulles, Richard Helms, Carmel Laughey, and Frank Wiesner were the grand masters. If you were in a room with them, you were in a room full of people that you had to believe would deservedly end up in hell." Angleton slowly sipped his tea and then said, "I guess I will see them there soon."
What were they supposed to be working on during World War II?
First thing they were supposed to be working on was getting secrets from the Germans and preventing the Germans from getting secrets from them. It was only later, at the end of the war, that British and American secret intelligence turned its attention to the Soviet Union. And at that point, and from 44, 45, the British secret intelligence official charged with getting secrets from the Soviet Union was Kim Philby, who was a source of intelligence information for the Soviets.
Kim Philby was born in Punjab in 1912, and Jim Angleton is born in where else, right? Boise, Idaho, in 1917, so 5 years apart. You say they could hardly have had more different beginnings. What were their early lives like, and what led them to the field of intelligence?
Kim Philby was a product of the Raj. As you say, he was born in India. His father was a very interesting character, much like T.E. Lawrence. The father, Sinjin Philby, was born in Ceylon, went to private schools, which were called public schools, in England, then went to Cambridge, University, joined the Indian Civil Service, rose through its ranks, and eventually became one of the founders of the Kingdom of Jordan, and was very, very close to Ibn Saud, the King of Saudi Arabia. As a matter of fact, Saud, in large part, owed his throne to St. John Philby. Well, then when Ken Philby was coming up, he followed the same path. He went to private schools in England. He went to Trinity College, Cambridge, and was very much part of the British ruling class from birth. James Angleton, as you said, was born in Boise, the thriving metropolis of Boise, beginning of the 20th century. His father was like something out of an elementary school biography of great men. He came out of a failing farming community in Indiana, moved west, young man, to Boise. He sold candy from stores in downtown Boise. Eventually, that got brought on by the National Cash Register Corporation, which at the time was a real high technology business in the United States. And he would carry these heavy cash registers around to the hills and valleys of Idaho and Montana, backs of mules, and teach shop owners how to use them. He was a very good salesman. He rose rapidly through the ranks at NCR. In the midst of that, there was the Pancho Villa incursion on the Mexican border. And since James Angleton Sr. was in the National Guard, he went down there. And as the song goes, down Mexico way, he found a young lady he appreciated, and he brought her back to Boise. So James Angleton, the James Angleton we're talking about, was what in California called a Chicano. He was half Mexican and half Anglo. As his father rose through the ranks of NCR, he eventually became a vice president. And when the Depression hit, he was sent to Europe to see what was going on with the branches there. He looked at the branch in Italy. And I'm not quite sure how this worked out, but in any case, he said, oh, this is good. And he took over the NCR franchise for Italy and ran it at pretty much as his own company. The family moved to Milan, where they lived in a palace. And the father was perhaps one or two most important American businessmen in Italy. This was during the fascist period. So James Angleton starts school in Boise, goes to school in Dayton, which was the headquarters of NCR, and then is privately taught in Italy. And his father then sends him to England, where he attends a private school, not as good as the one that Philby attended.
What can we glean from Kim Philby's early biography that leaves clues to he could be a double agent someday?
Yes. Well, his father didn't like the empire. Although he was a proconsul first in Iraq and then in Jordan, he became more and more identified with the Arab cause, again, like T.E. Lawrence. And he must have imbued this in his son. Another factor is that Ken Philby was in college, Cambridge, Trinity College, Cambridge University, as the Depression got worse and worse. And more people in Britain at that time were starving. Miners were spending all day in bed because they didn't have the energy to get out of it. There were hunger marches. And it became pretty clear that the system that was running the country, running the empire, didn't care much for most of the people who lived there. A lot of the undergraduates at Cambridge at the time, and particularly a group at Trinity College, decided that it would be best to join the Communist Party and see if the system could be overcome. I think that it needs to be understood that joining the Communist Party in the 30s did not mean becoming loyal to the Soviet Union. The largest Communist Party in the world at that time outside the Soviet Union was the German Communist Party. And there were strong communist parties everywhere, and was seen as an international movement. So Kim Philby and his friends, Guy Burgess, Donald McLean, Anthony Blunt, joined units of the Communist Party at the university. And Philby became more and more involved in this. He went on a series of trips to the European continent. He saw the rise to power of Hitler in Germany. And eventually, he married a young lady from Vienna, and she put him in touch with people who knew how to deal with young men who were idealistic. And they said to him, look, you can become an overt member of the party and do good things, sell the newspaper on street corners, or you can do something more interesting. But why don't you go back to your friends in Cambridge and say, I've seen the light, I've become a fascist. And so he did that. And once you do that, once you go underground, you're underground.
What do you think his motivation was?
Well, what he says his motivation was, and I have no reason not to believe this, was to make a better world, make a better world for, at that time were called the workers, but he would also mean for people in the colonies. The situation in India, which his father could have told him about, was very, very bad for 99% of the population there, which culminated during the Second World War in a deliberate famine imposed by Churchill in Bengal, in which 3 million people died of starvation. And that was not particularly outside the bounds of how things operated. And that was part of his motivation. I think also, and this is a bit confusing, I think he was a sociopath, that he liked to manipulate people. He liked to seem to be one kind of person and be another kind of person. He's very charming, as many sociopaths are. Not all of them. We know some sociopaths in the American government who aren't charming. Anyway, I think those were his motivations. He had a social, political motivation that was very clear and was common at the time. And then he had this, personal psychological motivation.
What led you to this story? I noticed in your introduction that you have an ode to your local library in Briarcliff Manor, which is just north of New York, which is where I'm from. I'm from the Bronx. Where were all these papers and what had not been discovered yet?
Okay, well, the local librarian is absolutely fabulous and gives me things from all over the world. But the basic original papers are in London for Philby and in Washington for Angleton. The papers in Washington for Angleton were the complete file of the OSS, the predecessor of the CIA. And they were brought there because William Casey, who had been head of the CIA, wanted to write a book about his heroic days in the OSS. So he had the whole file declassified and put into the National Archives, which is outside Washington, D.C. It's quite astonishing. There was also a huge data dump by the CIA a few years ago when the committees investigating the Kennedy assassination had issued the report. And there was a rule that they had to then release to the public everything that they had looked at. As far as I can tell, what happened was that the CIA said, we're not very happy about that, but in any case, they backed up a dump truck to the headquarters of the CIA and they put all kinds of stuff in it A lot of it had to do, of course, with the Kennedy assassination investigations, but there were things going back into the 1940s. So one can look at that, those two sources. The Kennedy assassination files are online. For Philby, the information is in London, in the National Archive there, which is in a place called Kew. And one can go there and read quite a bit of the secret documents. The British government doesn't much like releasing their documents, but one can do kind of a triangulation where if they have concealed the documents in Philby, you know that he sent letters, memoranda, and so forth to other people. So you look up their name and you go through it that way.
What led you to this particular story? What cried out to you that said this needs more attention?
I think Angleton has been neglected. I wrote a biography of him at one time that was concentrating on his psychology, I guess you would say, the way he looked at the world. But his actual professional life has been neglected. He was tremendously important in the CIA, as that paragraph I read you on his deathbed indicated. He used to carpool with the head of the CIA, and he was the CIA's representative to the Warren Commission investigating the assassination.
What is it like? What is it like reading spy cables and intercepts and memos written by spy people? What did you find yourself saying to yourself as you read through these documents? What's it like?
Well, often it's boring. At one point in Angleton's career, he was in Italy, and his job was to interview people who had come through the lines, the military line between the German and American forces. And you can sit at a desk in the National Archives in Washington and read hundreds of these things. Other times it can be very exciting, or just kind of, really? In the JFK assassination data dump, I came across a contract, which was from the CIA to an Italian, I think, saying, we'd like you to be an agent for us, and we'll pay you this amount a month. And if you're killed, please give us your next of kin so that we can give them some money to make things better for them. I was astonished. There's nothing in La Carre about agents having contracts.
What were the origins of the CIA and of MI6? I was shocked to read in your book that the offices of MI6 had survived largely intact after World War II. So tell us about, especially MI6, what are the origins of it? What was the organization like in its early days?
Okay, the British Secret Intelligence Services, there are, in the war, there were three, come from India. The British held India with very, very few people. And one of the ways that they did this was the Indian Intelligence Service. If you read Kim by Kipling, this is the organization that the young man eventually gets into. And it was a Gestapo. And they did a good job for the British. When World War II started, they imprisoned the entire leadership of the Congress Party, of the Nationalist Party, for example. Officers from that then were brought into England in the 30s, late 30s, and they formed two organizations, MI5 and MI6. MI5 was an internal organization, roughly the FBI, and MI6 was the external organization, which was the CIA ancestor. They were real, very small organizations. And they were staffed by friendship circles. when Philby got into it, for example, the head of the unit he was assigned to said, oh, we know your people, we'll hire you. And that was it. There was no more checking. The CIA came out of OSS. What had happened there was the United States had never had a foreign intelligence system. But when the Second World War started, a very colorful person named Wild Bill Donovan, that wasn't his formal name, but everybody called him Wild Bill Donovan, went to Roosevelt and said, we need something like MI6. So they formed this organization. And then at the end of the war, Truman said, Truman was president, he dissolved it. He said, we don't need that anymore. And then after a year or two, he said, oh yes, we do need that. And the people who had been in OSS, the most active people, particularly people who were in operations, then formed CIA. And it has continued and grown and thrived ever since.
What was life like for a spy? Give us a day in the life, if you can, based on what you've put together, for someone who is out there in the field in Europe in the 1940s and 50s, trying to A, get secrets, and B, keep secrets from being had.
Well, Philby just stayed at a desk in London and supervised the people you're talking about. Angleton, who was a much lower ranking person at the time, was sent to Italy. And in Italy, he had this very cinematic life. At one point, he wanted to turn an Italian fascist military guy. And so he jumped in his car and he said to his limo driver, take me to the fascist. And so they drove up through Italy to one of the northern cities. And they found the partisans, the anti-fascists, at the doorway of the apartment house in which this guy Borghese was hiding. So Angleton took out his trusty personal revolver, and they went around to the back door, and they ran up the stairs, and they found Borghese, and they took him down and bundled him, distracted the partisans, and then bundled him into the military vehicle and took him back to Rome. So that was probably a high point in movie land spydom. Most of the time, they interrogated people, made connections with them. Angleton was very good at making connections with other organizations. He became friendly with the people who later founded the Israeli secret intelligence system, the Mossad. And this becomes quite important. Israel had a secret intelligence system before it was a state. Angleton was instrumental in supporting that and watching them. And he was then, after Israel became independent, he was treated kind of as an uncle. And he had very good relations with them. In Italy, he had captured the Italian military intelligence system and secret intelligence system. So they operated in such a way as to do what he wanted them to do. So he controlled that intelligence system as well.
How did they meet, Kim Philby and Jim Angleton? Explain, I think it's 1944, right? What was the early time together like between them? And were they successful?
Well, it was teacher and student. Angleton had gone to Yale, and he was a very good poet. And he had mostly written poetry while he was at Yale, and published a book, a magazine called Furioso, which is probably the best student publication ever made. Then the war starts, and he doesn't really know what he wants to do. He gets drafted. He then gets co-opted into this organization, the OSS, which his father was already in. And they said, we'll send you to London and you learn how to be a spy. You learn how to be an intelligence official. So he goes to London and he's assigned as his teacher, Kim Philby, who was very important in MI6 counterintelligence. Counterintelligence is the discipline of trying to figure out what the other guy's intelligence system is doing. They had adjoining offices on Ryder Street, which could not be more posh as an address in London. And Philby taught him everything he thought that Angleton should know. And then when he thought he had learned enough, Philby and the OSS people sent Angleton to Italy, as I said, and Philby unofficially continued to supervise and support Angleton in Italy from his position in London as head of, as important in counterintelligence.
You say that in the 1950s and 60s, there were numerous intelligence disasters that, in hindsight, Angleton realized that the KGB had been along for the ride each time. He calls it Kim's work. What had been Kim's work? And also, I guess, explain, first of all, what some of the intelligence disasters were and how they helped out Kim Philby as a double agent.
Well, the one that's the clearest example is something that happened in the late 40s. The Brits and the Americans decided they wanted to roll back the communist influence in Eastern Europe, and that the easiest place to start was Albania, as it had been one of the last countries that had a communist government, and it was not a very formidable country. Still isn't a very formidable country. So what they decided to do was to train Albanian refugees to become subversives, to become, start a revolution. And they trained these, and they then took some of them by boat to Albania, and they parachuted some of them in. And strangely enough, none of them survived. They were all either shot on arrival or imprisoned. And it appears that what happened, and Philby said this is what happened, was that Philby was helping to coordinate this from London, and he would send instructions and information to these camps that where these people were being trained, apparently with carbon copies to Moscow. And so all these people died. A similar thing happened in Poland and in Germany. So everything that went through Philby's office as head of anti-Soviet operations for MI6 had copies sent to Moscow, and none of these projects worked.
And what do you imagine the moment was like when Angleton realized, uh-oh, I've been had by my own teacher?
He was very unhappy. what had happened, the way that Philby was first revealed was that there's an American project, Anglo-American project called Venona, where a cache of Soviet cables from the Second World War, which were encoded in such a way that they're impossible to read, were broken because there had been some carelessness to this. And they got the Americans and British who were working on this got some names out of this, just fragments. And one of those names was Donald McLean, who was Philby's friend. It didn't take long to realize that if Donald McLean was a Soviet source, then his friends were probably implicated. And they went to Philby and they said, hey, old man, are you also a Soviet source? And Philby said, oh, no, how could that be? That's completely a lie. And they couldn't break him because part of his profession was to break people, and he knew all the tricks. And they said, well, old man, I think you should retire. So they expelled him. But they didn't convict him of being a spy. They didn't say it was Sir Angleton was Sir. When Philby, after a while, got taken up again by his good friends in the MI6 and placed as a reporter for The Economist and The Observer in Beirut, Angleton set to work to catch him. That didn't work. He got away.
What information in particular did he pass to the Soviets?
He passed the names of every MI6 agent he had ever met, and descriptions of them and what they were doing and what and their address,
And what, I mean, that's pretty damaging. What was the payoff for him? What did he get out of this from them?
He got the satisfaction, on the one hand, psychologically, it must have been tremendously satisfying that he was steadily betraying all these people who were trusting him. On the other
hand, that's the sociopath part, I guess, right?
Yeah, yeah. On the other hand, he probably, and particularly in the early days, thought he was contributing to the Soviet cause. At this time, it was the Soviet cause.
Were they paying him?
No, they weren't paying him.
He did this for free.
He did it for free.
Oof. That's someone who believes in it.
There are, I think, three kinds of people that are called spies. There are government officials. Angleton was a government official with the Central Intelligence Agency. He was what's called a GS. He was a GS-15. Philby was a government official with MI6. That means you have pension rights and you have to keep track of your annual leave and all that kind of thing. The other kinds are agents. And agents are, as I said earlier, with the contract, people who are paid. They're like consultants or something. So they have a contract. They're going to be paid this much for doing these things. Those are agents. The third kind that's important are sources. And sources are people from whom officials or agents get information. And sources can be witting or unwitting. So the Soviets in particular, and I'm told that CIA people also, will go to a cocktail party in an embassy and say, hey, old man, you know, what's going on with your operations in this country? And the person will say, well, you know, I can't tell you anything about that. And then the agent or the official will file a report saying, my source says, you know, this. People confuse those things. Philby and his friends were never agents. They were always sources. And they were volunteered as sources. After Philby left Beirut in 1960-61, and went to Moscow, he had a very rough time. But the KGB was good to him. They gave him an apartment, they gave him an allowance, and they eventually gave him something to do. So I suppose he got that out of it. It's not much.
Poetically, perhaps, these two men died right as the Cold War was coming to a head, 1987, 1988. How did these two men influence the Cold War?
Angleton influenced the peak of the Cold War very strong. His job at CIA, or his official job, as opposed to his personal relations with people, was to make sure that the CIA was not infiltrated by the Soviets. So you have, the CIA had three main branches. Intelligence, which was supposed to go out and gather intelligence. It had operations, which was supposed to go out and overthrow governments. And and it had counterintelligence, which was trying to protect the CIA from other people. Angleton, as head of counterintelligence, would vet all the operations of both the operation people and the intelligence people. So the intelligence people would say, we have this guy, we think he's really good, we're going to send him to Berlin and he's going to find out everything. And Angleton would say, how do you know he's not a Soviet agent? And he'd have them go through thorough vetting of these people. And the same thing with the operations. On the Bay of Pigs, for example, he was asked about it, and he said, that's not going to work. And the people who were planning it overruled him, but that was the last time they overruled him. So it was one effect on the Cold War, was Angleton protected the CIA from Soviet infiltration. Early on, the strongest effect was Philby's. All these efforts to roll back the Soviet governments in Eastern Europe failed. And a large part of the responsibility for that was Philby's.
I guess when you pass the names of everybody working against you, it's tough to work against you. Go ahead, yeah.
Okay.
Now, what can we learn about the way from this story? What can we learn about the way the KGB operates, particularly in light of what we've seen the last half dozen years, interfering in elections, interfering on social media, the long game that they seem to play against the United States and against American interests? They're always looking to take the American empire down, almost like they're obsessed. What can we learn about that based on this story?
Oh, well, that started in Soviet days. They were doing that almost from the beginning. It's partially, the Brits were doing that against the Soviets, and I think the Americans were doing that against the Brits. This is something, a clash of empires. And I would imagine it'll go on and on. And the Russians are very, very good at it. And they seem to be getting better at it, as a matter of fact. So there's two. The issue is, why are they doing it? But they're doing it because they want to protect their country, and to do that by weakening other countries that they see as a threat. And we are certainly doing that. If you look at the so-called color revolutions that occurred at the time of the fall of the Soviet Union, who benefited?
You say the lasting influence of a charismatic teacher has become a cliche in terms of storytelling. Why do you think that has such resonance with so many people? And how should we amend that cliche to make it more effective and more relevant?
I think that there's informal and formal methods. The Jesuits, for example, notoriously did this in a formal way. They said, send your kids to our schools and we'll answer for them for the rest of their lives. There's a way in which elite American universities and elite British universities, and certainly elite French universities, do the same sort of thing. That one thing you learn when you go to Yale is math or history. Another thing that you learn is to act like a Yaleman and to do things that are consistent with the kind of culture that Yale wishes to perpetuate. And there's informal things. You know, teachers are in a way substitutes for parents. And sometimes the more charismatic teachers are even replaced parents in the growth, in the emotional and intellectual growth of a child. What you can do about that, I have no idea. I don't even know whether you should do anything about
that. Yeah. It resonates with a lot of people. What can we learn based on this story about alliances in our own lives? I guess few of us have the stakes that Kim Philby and Jim Angleton did, but What can we take away from human nature watching these two stories, or watching this story?
That's a very interesting question. I suppose a psychoanalyst would say that what you want to do is to make conscious those things that are unconscious. That when you have a strong attachment to a teacher, for example, you want to work through how much of that is rationally justified and how much of that is looking for daddy or mommy, as the case may be. Angleton was clearly attracted to strong male figures. And Philby wanted to kill them.
What advice should the CIA in particular, but also MI6, take away from this story?
Well, they should have a strong counterintelligence system. Yeah. Yeah. When Angleton was finally fired, the then head of the CIA fired him. And not only fired him, but took apart the counterintelligence staff. And as far as we know, there were no penetrations of the CIA between 1974 and 1954 and 1970, when Angleton was head of counterintelligence. After that, there was Alger James and various other people. And it took a long time before they reestablished their counterintelligence system.
There have been some pretty recent counterintelligence lapses where some people did pass secrets to different agencies, including nuclear secrets.
Yeah.
Did that resonate with you when you were going through the material for this book?
Yeah. Those people wanted money. People like Philby were ideological sources of information. The only ideological source that I can remember is the Israeli fellow. Was in jail for 20 years or something like that for passing American secrets.
When you go through... Oh, go ahead, Tim.
Basically, it's different these days. It's money. Yeah.
When you go through this story, it cries out for a movie, I think. Would you like to see this turned into... I'm sure you will. I'm sure you'd love to sell it to a major motion picture company, but does this need a movie?
There's a lot of movies these days. I think that, you know, it would clearly make a vivid movie. I spent a lot of time in Los Angeles, and what I know about Hollywood is that if you sell something to the studios, you should go away and never see the movie.
What story do you want to tell next? What characters out there, what situations out there do you think cry out for this kind of exploration and examination?
I'm working on a big project that isn't about this, but when I'm finished with that, I think it would be interesting to do something about a man named Frank Wiesner, who was in OSS and eventually became head of the operations part of the CIA, the part that was trying to overthrow governments and so forth. When he was in OSS, he was assigned to go to Bucharest. And at the time, in 1944, Romania had a very small aristocracy and then peasants. And he, I believe, became intimate with some of the Romanian aristocrats, and that this then influenced the way that when, as he became more and more powerful, he acted in Eastern Europe. There's a story that during the 1956 Hungarian uprising, he went to the Austrian-Hungarian border and watched the refugees come across. And it is said that as a consequence, he had a nervous breakdown from that. I think that's a pretty colorful story.
Michael Holtzman, bringing us one colorful story after another. The author of Spies and Traitors, Kim Philby, James Angleton, and the Friendship and Betrayal That Would Shape MI6, the CIA, and the Cold War. thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
His book is available now from Pegasus Books. I want to invite listeners to our Patreon page to ask for your support in keeping the show going. Go to patreon.com/axelbankhistory. We will donate part of your contributions to a charity for children's literacy. Thank you for listening to Axel Bank Reports, History and Today, conversations with America's top nonfiction authors and why their books matter right now. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Axel Bank History. We update those with clips from the show, guest announcements, and book recommendations. See you next time. Thanks.